Marines veteran, and as well to Alicia Garza, co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement, special projects director for the National Domestic Workers Alliance. That does it for our broadcast. We have job openings at Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Is hiring a director of finance and operations, as well as a director of development. Visit democracynow.org for more information. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wells, Laura Gottes, Dina Gester, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and the time is 7:59. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Political Perspectives, we speak with professor and author Rebecca Gordon about a recent article, Republican Presidential Contenders Compete to See Who Can Kill and Torture the Most, and about what happens when a nation is never prosecuted for its war crimes. And at 9:30, we hear former Congress member Cynthia McKinney on her State of the Union. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on the Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen talks with guest Jim Gilbert about pruning kiwis and persimmons, suggestions about what you can use for mulch, and chilling hours, and why many plants need them to thrive. Thanks very much for listening to KBOO, and thanks, members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned for Talk Radio with Paul Rowland.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, on Thursday, January 14th at 7 p.m., KBOO at the Clinton will show Freedom on My Mind, How Voting Rights Were Won in Mississippi, with post-film Poetic Justice, open mic poetry event with poet and MC John Slaughter. Freedom on My Mind chronicles the complex and compelling history of the Mississippi voter registration struggles of 1961 to 1964. The interracial nature of the campaign, the tensions and conflicts, the fears and hopes. Again, that's Freedom on My Mind, Thursday, January 14th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
My landlord's a wealthy man, a living off rent like the fat of the land.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of Eviction Free 2016, a rally in March organized by Portland Tenants United. On January 15th at 4:30 p.m., tenants will gather at Portland City Hall to demand an end to no-cause evictions, landlord retaliation, and persistent discrimination against racial minorities. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the page under Community Events.
Hello, neighbors, if you try to stop an eviction, I'd be by your side. Hello, neighbors, you know you should fight for right for the common good.
On Religion for Life, we ask, is religion worth rescuing?
The enemy is not religion per se. It's rigid conventionality, a way of thinking that's rule-based.
Psychologist John Van Hagen is my guest. He talks about his book, Rescuing Religion, How Faith Can Survive Its Encounter with Science.
Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
Give me one reason to stay here, and I'll turn right back around.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, and accessories with a focus on natural fibers. Since 1984, Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at gazellenaturalfiberclothing.com.
And good morning. You are listening to Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO. My name is Paul Rowland. We're going to be talking about the necessity of disobedience this morning with our guest Tim DeChristopher. Climate change is on trial in Seattle. While a group of armed anti-government militants casually tears down fences and easily accesses personal and official files in their second week of occupying the Malheur Wildlife Refuge offices in eastern Oregon. Another group of protesters in Seattle goes on trial for blocking a mile-long oil train in September of 2014. The case of the Delta 5, as they've come to be called, went to court on Monday in Snohomish County District Court. Now, this trial is attracting quite a bit more attention than a misdemeanor civil disobedience case ordinarily would, because the judge in the case has allowed the defendants to use the necessity defense. If you're not familiar with this, this defense argues that it is legitimate and justified to commit a lesser crime in order to prevent a greater harm. A classic example would be breaking into a building in order to save someone from a fire. Allowing this defense means that expert witnesses can be called to support the argument that climate change is more dangerous than the group's alleged crimes of trespassing and blocking a train. And it means that a jury of their peers will actually be able to decide on the merits of these larger and deeper contextual arguments. Our guest, Tim DeChristopher, is himself no stranger to high-profile civil disobedience cases. In 2011, he was convicted in Utah on two federal felony charges relating to an action at a bitterly contested Bureau of Land Management auction for oil and gas leases adjacent to Canyonlands National Park. As Bidder 70, DeChristopher bid on and won numerous parcels, thus keeping them from corporate exploitation. This, of course, did not go over well with those who organized the auction, because he clearly had no intention of, well, actually, he later did try to come up with some money, I believe, for that. But anyway, we'll talk about all that. They ruled him an outlier and an illegitimate bidder. And for that gesture, he got a 2-year federal sentence, and he served 21 months of that. In his trial, the judge disallowed the necessity defense. He was released from prison on April 21st, 2013. He's now studying social justice movements at Harvard Divinity School. And he's also co-founder of the Climate Disobedience Center, which serves as a, quote, catalyst for direct action, creating points of vivid moral clarity, emboldening both climate activists and the unlikeliest of allies, capturing the heart and soul of the climate debate. That's from their website, www.climatedisobedience.org. And they are at this trial, and we'll be talking about that. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
You're quite welcome. So what's the feel like there at this, at the courtroom? I assume you've been attending this trial so far.
Yes. I've been here all week for this trial, and there's a lot of energy here. People are really fired up. There's been a ton of supporters. There were well over 100 folks here the first day, overflowing the courtroom, standing around outside, and just showing all their support for the Delta 5 defendants. And so far, this trial has gone pretty much as well as I ever could have imagined. The judge has been allowing the defendants to make the fullest and most open case that they can, and particularly yesterday, when the first four defendants were taking the stand, they were able to really just tell their whole story and tell the whole story of climate change and why civil disobedience is necessary, and say things that I didn't think I'd get to hear in an American courtroom. So it was really exciting to see.
And for the record, what's the judge's name? I wasn't able to find it online anywhere.
The judge's name is Anthony Howard. He's probably the youngest judge that I've ever seen. He's about my age, which I think might have something to do with the fact of why he's allowing us to address climate change in this way in his courtroom. That he's of the age that he's probably still going to be around in 2050.
You must be sort of feeling a little bit like that this, your life has sort of led up to this moment in a sense. This seems like exactly what you're sort of cut out to do, given your life history. It must be really interesting to see this, because I think there is a case, I've been an activist for for a long time myself, and I remember back in the day when we were getting arrested for climbing trees and you know, protesting the cutting of the ancient forest here in the Northwest, that we're always, well, how about the necessity defense? You know, it's like they're destroying the last of our magnificent forests. We have to be able to. And then our lawyers, of course, would say, no, you know, you're risking, you know, you risk going to prison, et cetera. There's always that game you play in deciding how much do you want to risk personally? You know, what do you think you can get? All those calculations, you know, that you make. And of course, you know, there's often tension with the lawyers. I don't recall, I'm not sure if we ever did use that necessity defense. There have been attempts to use it throughout the years. And I believe there was one case in a climate case just a year or two ago, but there was something that it didn't go all the way to trial. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that. But anyway, yeah, talk about this necessity defense, what that means to you as an activist. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, you said that it seems like this is the kind of case that my life has led up to. And that's certainly what it has felt like for me. It has been, you know, just over 7 years now that this kind of climate necessity defense is really what I've focused on and worked for and waited for all these years. This is exactly the kind of trial that I wanted to be able to have in my case, and was certainly highly restricted, and the kind of case that I've supported others to try to make happen, the kind of case that we were hoping for in the lobster boat blockade trial back in Massachusetts a couple of years ago. So this is what we've worked for and pushed for to make happen. So it's certainly exciting to see that.
And so, you know, this. What's your role there as the climate? Talk a little bit about the Climate Disobedience Center, how that came to be, and what's its role in this trial and generally.
Yeah, so the Climate Disobedience Center is a group that we pulled together in the wake of that lobster boat blockade trial, which was an action where folks anchored a lobster boat in front of the Braden Point coal-fired power plant in Massachusetts, and then took their case to trial. And that was actually the first case I know of that was allowed to use the necessity defense that got that ruling from the judge. But then they ended up not actually making that defense because on the first day of their trial, the district attorney took over the prosecution and dropped all the criminal charges and then came outside to all the supporters that we had gathered and gave this big speech about how he was dropping the charges out of concern for all the children who would be impacted by climate change, and said that there's been serious failure of political leadership on this issue. And so with Jay O'Hara and Ken Ward and Marla Markham, who are the main organizers behind that action, we pulled together this center to try to support other folks who are engaging in civil disobedience and try to help our movement realize the full potential of that civil disobedience, to do it in a principled and powerful kind of way that could really arouse the conscience of our communities through these acts of civil disobedience. And so that's both supporting folks before they take actions and supporting folks as they go to trial. So we've been working with the Delta 5 defendants for the last few months, both giving them some legal support. You know, they were able to get good lawyers in their case out here. They were able to get good pro bono lawyers. Their team is led by Robert Goldsmith, who actually has won a necessity defense case on, I believe, a nuclear weapons case years ago. And also MJ McCallum and Bridge Joyce and Evelyn Chong and Patrick Mazza, one of the defendants, is defending himself. So in this case, they had a solid legal team, and we offered some of our insight as their case developed. But in this case, we ended up doing more of the organizing, of trying to connect what's going on inside the courtroom to what's going on outside in the larger campaigns here in the Northwest and in the climate movement in general. So we've been helping with media support, and we're trying to translate what's been going on inside the courtroom to the movement context.
You know, it's interesting. There seems to be a confluence of things going on that's really rather remarkable. I mentioned at the outset, and I'd like to talk a little bit about that, what's going on out in Eastern Oregon. And that, again, touches your history as well, because the Bundys, of course, faced off with the Bureau of Land Management in Nevada, and you were dealing with the Bureau of Land Management regarding those oil and gas leases that you bid on and ended up spending prison time for. And of course, the feds backed off on the Bundys in that conflict over unpaid grazing fees that the Bundys basically gotten away with. And, you know, they actually faced down with weapons, federal agents, and got away with that. And now they seem to be emboldened, and two of the Bundy sons are up here in Oregon and causing some havoc in the community of Burns. So, I'd like to talk a little bit about that, the differential treatment of environmental activists and these so-called right-wing militias. But another thing that's really interesting is that in King County in Seattle, there's another landmark case, the Children's Trust case, where a judge ruled that this lawsuit could go forward on there's children who are bringing lawsuits all around the country. Really quite similar to this case that you guys are involved with there, where children are claiming that, you know, their future is imperiled. And so that I haven't really absorbed all the legal aspects of it, but it seems like there's a lot of interesting legal breakthroughs going on kind of at the same time. Maybe you want to talk first about that latter one.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Our Children's Trust case that has been moving forward here in Washington and has been introduced in a lot of different places around the country actually is much more closely related to what's going on here in the Delta Five trial than the militants out in Oregon. the folks in Oregon is not a civil disobedience case. You know, if you have an assault weapon and you say you're willing to shoot people, then it's not civil disobedience, and I think that's pretty straightforward. One of the key dynamics that is emerging in this trial is the difference between protest as a way to intimidate or protest as a way to expose one's own vulnerability to arouse the conscience of those around them. And the folks out in Oregon, in Malheur, they're making it very clear that they're all about intimidation to try to get their way. And that's what happened with the Bundys down in Nevada, and unfortunately they were able to get away with that. But the Our Children's Trust case, I think, is much more closely related to what's going on here with the Delta Five, because that, again, is activism that is based on one's own vulnerability. So it's young people that are bringing the case and exposing their own vulnerability to the climate crisis and the vulnerability of their future to the actions that we collectively are taking right now. And that's really the same inherent approach that the Delta Five activists had when they erected a tripod and stood in front of a train, and Abby Brockaway went 25 feet up in that tripod, putting herself at risk, but exposing her own vulnerability. And using that as a call to conscience, and that I think is the heart of civil disobedience, and what we're really trying to bring to light in this trial and in a lot of the increased civil disobedience that's going on throughout the climate movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to again mention that I'm talking with Tim DeChristopher, who's in Seattle for this landmark trial of the Delta Five. As Tim was just explaining, they locked themselves to a tripod, one of them on the top of the tripod, to block a mile-long oil train back in September of 2014. And they're on trial in Snohomish County District Court now up in Seattle. And they've been allowed the necessity defense, which we've been talking a lot about, which is sort of the holy grail of a certain kind of activist in going through the legal system, kind of using the legal system to challenge these larger issues. And it's a very, very rare that it's able to go forward. Anyway, we're talking about that and a bunch of other things. And the number to call in if you want to talk to Tim is 503-231-8187. I understand he may have to leave a little bit early, so you may want to get your calls in early. Don't wait until the top of the hour, please. Feel free to call in anytime. This is your chance to talk to Tim DeChristopher, find out what's going on up in Seattle, what's going on with his new group, the Climate Disobedience Center, and just have a general conversation about a really unique time in history. Let's just put it that way. I know there's so much going on, of course, here in Portland. We've had a lot of stuff happening with the Fenneca protests of last year, with the city council making these major statements that are resonating internationally on fossil fuel infrastructure, on oil trains. To the extent they're actually going to have any real-world impact kind of remains to be seen, but they're certainly, at least on the symbolic level, important gestures. So there's a lot going on. There's a lot to talk about. Let's have a conversation about all this. So, you know, getting back a little bit to your own history, and, you know, you said that you agreed that my intuition was somewhat accurate, that this trial sort of is sort of you were made to do this with your activist history. Talk a little bit about your own activist history. You know, I don't know how many young people are listening. I don't know how many people who've never engaged in civil disobedience. You know, how did you come to believe that of the, as I put it in the title, the necessity of disobedience?
Well, I've been an environmentalist for a long time, and it was in 2007 and early 2008 that I started to get a lot more focused on climate change and just how late in the game we were on climate change and how urgent the situation was. And so I was really trying to get more heavily involved in the climate movement, and at the same time I was also studying social movement history and seeing that the climate movement at that time really looked nothing like any of the successful social movements in our history. Because at that point the climate movement was still really trying to appease those at the top of our power structure. They were trying to make the movement seem as non-threatening as possible and make the case for a cleaner, greener version of the world that we have now, in which we could just switch out our power sources and keep everything else about society the same, and try to make that sort of tolerable or amenable to those who profit from the status quo. And looking at our social movement history, I saw that that the social movements that are successful are those who are willing to challenge that power structure, not appease it. Those who articulate a big and inspiring vision of a healthy and just world, and a vision of justice, and that kind of idealism and that kind of confrontation were entirely missing from most of the climate movement around 2008. And so, you know, I was looking for folks to lead us towards a more confrontational social movement that embraced things like civil disobedience. And so I was sort of looking for the leaders who were going to take that first step. And I saw that we didn't have them. And so I realized that I was going to have to do that, and I was looking for opportunities to take that kind of action. And then this Bureau of Land Management auction came around that seemed the perfect opportunity, because it was the confluence of not only the climate crisis, but the land use issues that were so salient in Utah, and also the lack of a participatory and democratic process where the public had largely been locked out of the decision-making process for public lands. So I decided that this was a point for me to take action. And And, you know, at the time, it was shortly after the King's North 6 case that happened in the UK, where a bunch of Greenpeace activists did a rather large action to completely shut down a coal-fired power plant, and the six activists that scaled the smokestack of the plant were later charged, and they were able to make the necessity defense because the necessity defense comes from common law, so it's what we sort of inherited from the English legal system. So they were able to make that defense. They were able to put folks like Dr. James Hansen from NASA on the stand to testify that the threat of climate change was so huge that they had a necessity to take this action, and that they actually prevented greater harm than they caused to the plant by keeping it shut down for that one day. So I was inspired by that and saw that as something that we needed to see happen in this country, because I felt like, you know, we can take action as activists and as the small minority of folks that are involved in the climate movement, and we can show through our own actions that we feel like this situation is so urgent and our government response is so inadequate that we have a responsibility to take action, and that even breaking the law is justified. And so that's always a minority voice when we alone are doing it. But then when we take our case before six random people who are selected as jury members, or 12 random people who are selected as jury members, who are not climate activists, they're just regular citizens who were called to show up for jury duty. And when six or 12 random citizens can unanimously decide that those activists were right, that we have come to this point where the crisis is so severe and our government response is so inadequate that we have a responsibility to take action, even in violation of the law. That's I think, when the moral authority of our current power structure really begins to unravel, when we get to that point of taking our case before a jury of our peers and they side with us and acquit people using the necessity defense. And so that's part of the vision that I've had for a long time, and this week feels like we're taking a big step closer towards getting to that point.
You know, I got to say, as an activist, not so active at this point, except I guess through radio, but I took part in some protests against auctions, timber sale auctions back in the day, and. You know, I just got to hand it to you, because I don't remember anyone actually, I don't remember discussions, there must have been discussions about actually, bidding on the sale. But, you know, sometimes, obviously, you paid a pretty serious price. 21 months in federal prison is, I've never spent time in federal prison. I've only spent like a couple days in jail, which was, you know, kind of striking in its own way, but nothing to compare. And, I've talked to people who spent long stretches in prison. It's not, it's not an easy thing to do. So I don't know how much you weighed those future consequences in your spontaneous action, but just at the level of action, got to hand it to you, because, that's what, they've got the other side, the industrial, whatever industrial complex you want to talk about has the organization, the machinery, the money. But we sometimes do have the element of surprise. So anyway, I just want to hand it to you there. But we do have some callers to join this conversation. Let's go to our first caller. Derek, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much. I am a great supporter, morally, of civil disobedience, and of, considered being arrested myself, but job considerations come into play and so on. But I also heard some really compelling arguments in the last few years about the importance of the rule of law, basically around the civil rights abuses that came in under George Bush post 9/11 and so on, and the importance of, like Guantanamo was kind of like an outside the law thing, and we've been trying to get rid of that for, as long as it's been there. So in civil disobedience, you break the law, but how do you reconcile that with the importance of the rule of law I sort of think I get a little bit of an idea, but maybe you could explain the theory of breaking the law and then going to court.
Yeah, so the rule of law, you know, in its origins, the idea of a rule of law is that it is a law that applies equally to everyone, that everyone has equal footing under the law. And I think we've seen in a lot of ways that we don't have that in this country. You know, certainly we're seeing it on display with all of the police trials or lack of police trials that we're seeing in so many of the police shootings around the country.
Right.
And we've seen it on display to an even greater extent with the way the corporations are not held to the same standards of law that the rest of us are. You know, one of the actual charges that I was convicted of, and it tends to 2 years just for this charge, was making false statements to federal officials, because when I checked into the auction, the form that I signed said that any bids that I make will be bona fide bids. And so just for signing that form, I was sentenced to 2 years in prison for making false statements to federal officials. You know, we've learned recently that ExxonMobil knew about climate change, accepted that there was a scientific consensus on climate change since the 1970s and early 80s, and then spent decades lying about it, lying on congressional panels, lying to federal officials, lying in their public statements, hiring people for the sole purpose of lying to the government. They were running a criminal operation. They were running a criminal conspiracy to lie to the federal government, and they're certainly not held accountable. So we've seen that the rule of law doesn't exist. But even more fundamentally, the rule of law gains its moral authority. What upholds the rule of law is that it is meant to be in line with the shared values of the citizenry, of the community. It was understood, I think, by the people who set up our legal system that the actual law, as it's practiced, can drift away from the shared values of our community. And it's often been acts of civil disobedience that bring the two back into alignment. And so that's why the fundamental structure of our legal system, of our criminal system in this country, is that when people break a law, that they take their case before a jury of their peers, a jury of citizens, who can decide if that person should be convicted. And so I think civil disobedience is actually written into the structure of our legal system, whereby if the legislature is passing laws that are out of line with the values of our community, citizens can violate those laws, take their case before a jury of their peers, who can decide if those actions are justified. So I think it's fundamentally in line with the rule of law. And, you know, certainly a lot of activists in the past have pled guilty in their cases. And I think that's still pretty common for civil disobedience. To me, guilt is twofold. You know, on the one hand, guilt is a feeling. It's an emotional or spiritual perspective, and I think if people are taking civil disobedience actions in line with their conscience and doing it in a principled way, I think most of us don't have guilt in that sense. So I think pleading guilty is dishonest on that emotional and spiritual level. On the other hand, legally, guilt is what happens when someone has been convicted by a jury of citizens. That's the legal structure for our society, and it's become increasingly common as our legal system has evolved for defendants to take plea bargains. And in fact, the means of mass incarceration in this country is that nearly everyone who's accused is pressured into a plea bargain, and we have very few jury cases. So it's sort of been forgotten that guilt actually legally is what happens when you've been convicted by a jury. So that also, you know, before we go to a jury, when we're just appearing in court for a hearing in front of the judge, I also think it's disingenuous, and and cuts the role of citizens out of the process to plead guilty at that point. So so I very strongly advocate for activists to take their cases to trial and in front of a jury of their peers whenever possible.
Derek, do you have any other?
Thanks for all that info. I love it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling. So taking up on that, and again, you know, we have a, it seems like we have some lines open for people to call in. Call in now, because I think Tim might have to leave a little bit before the top of the hour. 503-231-8187. You know, obviously, you know, you're not saying that someone, you know, who's, you know, in a really difficult situation should just plead guilty because, you know, on principle, because obviously everybody's faced with all kinds of considerations and, you know, don't necessarily, certainly don't likely have the kind of support that the Delta 5 defendants are having from both, you know, their own communities and a wider support from groups like your own. I mean, obviously, it would be certainly wonderful if we had support groups all around the country that are able to support people in their decision, both, you know, financially and with legal assistance, all the people who, you know, are pleading and perhaps taking prison jail or prison time that they wouldn't necessarily get if they had a jury trial. Obviously, it would be wonderful if we had, you know, the millionaire class backing such efforts. Actually, I'm not sure where I wanted to go with that, but we do have another call. Go ahead.
I think that we do have much greater networks of support than we give ourselves credit for a lot of times. You know, for me, that was one of the most powerful parts of my whole experience of going through my whole legal process, was realizing that there was a community there ready to support me and ready to have my back, even though I didn't know that they were there before I took that action. And that community to support me only really formed and came together and made themselves known once I was in that vulnerable position and I actually needed their help. And a large part of that came from my church community and also just from a broader community of young people throughout Salt Lake City and the climate movement around the country. You know, we've seen the same thing happening here. Like, a lot of the supporters who have shown up for the Delta 5 this week and have put a lot of effort into organizing around their trial have come from Abby Brockway, the lead defendant, have come from her church, her Presbyterian church in the Woodlawn neighborhood of Seattle, which, you know, she's told me in a lot of her previous climate activism, when she's tried to involve the church, they've sort of allowed her to do her thing, you know, and sort of voice some of their support, but have never really been actively engaged. And it wasn't until she was actually in trouble and was actually in a vulnerable position and really needed their help that they've really stepped up in a huge way. And, you know, now they're becoming a really bold and proud climate justice congregation. And I think that's only happened because Abby put herself in that situation and invited them to be that supporting community. And I think we've got a lot of those latent social networks throughout our communities, throughout this country and throughout the climate movement that are sort of just waiting to be needed, that are waiting to be asked to do bold things and to step up. And I think, we just need to ask them to be there for us.
Yeah, I guess I was referring more to, you know, not to activists, not to civil disobedience cases, but to, quote, regular, quote, criminal trials, you know, and if, obviously I'm sure you would agree with me that, you know, communities of color that have been so devastated and hard hit by this selective application of laws and profiling and all that, and are, you know, maybe have prior convictions on, you know, on profiled type cases, and they just feel like, anyway, we don't need to go to belabor that, but
I certainly agree with that.
Yeah. So we do have another caller. Bill, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. I'm listening to this and I'm often argue the fact that most of what we think with respect to something like the Supreme Court's decision to give corporations the rights of people and thereby allowing corporations to influence law, which they have since the industrialist time. But this notion that somehow we are violating laws by protesting, and often we have corporations or politicians hiding behind these actual laws to protect unjust positions. And often it's hard to get to the bottom of how do we protect ourselves? How do people actually hold their government accountable, who's often hijacked by corporations and other wealthy influence? And so it's kind of a, you know, you're putting a cross in that if you're not willing to test or violate conditions of certain rules, then somehow it never holds anyone accountable, especially the people who can continue their same practices. So I guess civil disobedience is a great way to bring this to the light or the forefront, but unfortunately, some people, well, I guess we're all caught up trying to make a day-to-day living somehow, and it seems that we often say that those who challenge these laws are on the fringes, when really I believe they're really at the center of what matters.
Yeah, and you know, that role of the corporate collusion with government is sort of on the periphery of this case, but it's a really strong undercurrent that I didn't even realize very much until the trial began. And so it's something that's starting to emerge, and I think it's going to get a little more focus as we move towards the closing arguments in this case. And the reason for that is that the rail yard where the activists were blocking the train was a BNSF rail yard, the Burlington Northern Santa Fe. And so it was actually Burlington Northern Santa Fe police officers that arrested the activists. There were local Everett, Washington police officers that were on the scene, but they didn't do the arresting. And so the reason that the Burlington Northern agents were able to arrest these activists is that Burlington Northern is the only private company in the United States that has actual commissioned police officers as part of their company. So the company itself can commission state and federal police officers. And the reason for that is that Burlington Northern isn't actually just a private company. And the prosecution is certainly trying to frame this whole case about being about private property, and it's just trespass that these activists were on private property and they weren't supposed to be there. But the fact is that Burlington Northern is not just a private company. It has land all the way across the country that was given to it by us, by the taxpayers, by the government, that was public land, and they were given that corporate license because they were supposed to be serving the public. And the reason that they're able to do things like commission their own police officers who can make arrests is that they are, in fact, a quasi-public-private institution, but they don't have any public responsibilities that go with those rights of being a public institution. So the activists here, they didn't have any public process to participate in. They couldn't submit public comments to Burlington Northern. They couldn't show up at the public hearings that Burlington Northern has when they make decisions about rolling oil trains through their communities. So the only way for their voice to be heard is to trespass. And with so much of the corporate takeover of public space that has happened in this country, that's the position that we are in, where if we want our voices to be heard, then we must trespass. And so that's an exciting piece of this case that is starting to come to light. And I hope that it's something that becomes a part of this story as it's increasingly being told by media around the country and around the world.
Mm-hmm. So I guess our caller is left. Again, 503-231-8187. You might be able to get in another call or two here before Tim has to go. So I read something. Again, I am talking with Tim DeChristopher, the activist who spent 21 months in a federal prison for falsely bidding on a oil and gas lease. And of course, it should be noted that those areas ended up being protected, right? That you bid those on those leases, right?
Yes. The auction was later canceled, and most of those parcels were rescinded, and then that began a very long process that is still continuing to determine what kind of lasting protections that land is going to have.
So that was a successful action in the end. So I read something before we go to our next call real quick. I understood there's possibly a whistleblower from BNSF who might testify in this case. Is that true?
Yes, there's a former BNSF employee who is going to take the stand, I believe, later today.
Uh-huh. Can you say anything about that? Do you know anything about that?
I can't really say anything about what his testimony is going to be.
Okay. And again, Tim DeChristopher is at this trial, the Delta 5, and there's a website, I believe it's delta5trial.org.
That's right.
Yeah, Delta 5 and the number 5, delta5trial.org, if you want to find out more about that. Let's go to our next caller. Lee, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. Tim, thank you very much. I'd like to know more about your organization, but the comment I have is a recommendation of a book by Howard Zinn entitled Disobedience and Democracy, Nine Fallacies of Law and Order. I highly recommend it to everyone. It's been one of the most interesting books I've read in the past 5 years.
All right. Well, thank you for that.
Thank you.
Do you know that book, Tim?
I do. It's on my shelf at home, but I haven't read it yet. So I'll bump it up towards the top of the list.
Okay. And let's just go straight to our next caller. Patty, you're on the air. Oh, no. Patty has already left us. You can take that dial tone down there. Do we have any other callers? Okay, we're waiting for that. And again, we have Tim DeChristopher on, and we're talking about the Delta 5 trial going on up in Seattle. And, you know, I'd like to mention this book. I've been meaning to say this. Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. I can't recommend this more. I can't believe I put off reading it for this long, but I'm well into this, and it has everything to do with what we're talking about now, and especially the differential treatment of environmental activists and other, especially these right-wing militants who are there seemingly having their way with our federal land out at the Malheur. And Will Potter is just if you don't know him, check out his blog, Green is the New Red. It's just really wonderful, and it talks a lot about the criminalizing of civil disobedience and the lumping civil disobedience together with under the rubric of terrorism. Would you like to say anything about that?
Yeah, you know, I've read that book, and I think it does tell a good story of how we got to this point of really trying to villainize activists, particularly environmental activists, and I think it also shows the importance of telling our own stories as activists. You know, part of the reason that the movement was able to be vilified for a while, and that narratives like eco-terrorism were even able to be created, was that I think kind of in the wake of the COINTEL revelations of the 1970s, there was an era of secrecy for environmental activists that I think was extremely counterproductive, where activists really refused to tell their own stories and tried to be as secretive as possible. And so when they were taking direct action, they were basically creating a platform where their opponents could tell their stories, and their opponents could step up and say, let me tell you who these environmental activists are and what they want and why you should be afraid of them, why we should pass draconian rights to crack down on them. So that's, I think, part of what happened when the activists themselves weren't able to or weren't willing to step up and say, this is who we are, let us tell you who we are and why we did what we did. And, you know, that's what we're seeing in this trial this week, that the activists are able to tell their own story, and the prosecution's efforts to fearmonger around these activists, I think, are really failing, both with the media and I suspect with the jury as well, that they're seeing that these are people who are acting in a principled and really responsible way, and that's because they were able to tell their own story. And I think that's also part of the value of creativity. You know, in my case, I was able to tell my own story because it was a somewhat unprecedented tactic. So there wasn't an existing narrative, and I was able to set the narrative myself, tell my own story of who I was and what I was doing. And so it put my opponents, it put the fossil fuel industry and their government allies in a position of trying to rewrite that existing narrative, which, you know, as a lot of us know, is much harder. Once the narrative is already established, like jobs versus the environment or something like that, it's a lot harder to try to unpack and rewrite that narrative. But when we're willing to tell our own stories from the get-go, we can claim that ground and hold it much easier. So that's what I'm excited to see, that this trial, these activists have told their story the whole time, and they've really got the momentum on their side.
Well, Tim, I know you've got to get back to court here pretty soon. Do you have time to take another call?
Yep. Perhaps real quick. I've got to get in about 3 minutes.
Okay, Patty, go ahead.
Okay, I'm so glad I got on because, boy, this is very timely. I'm not sure about that particular trial, but I've been an activist my whole life and rarely involved with others, a little bit in Tucson with the nonviolence thing. But for the last 15 years, and in fact right now I'm going through it in Salem, I don't live in Oregon, but I've been held for charges for about 7 months. And so I don't have housing. I'm kind of in this limbo as they wait for me to just take the plea. This homelessness thing is really getting to me, and the more I look into it, the more I see how they're just hiding that. And I'm feeling really frustrated by the lack of advocacy groups here in Salem, because right now I am just exhausted, but I will still get out there. But how do you suggest I gather some support?
Calling into a radio show and voicing your support on an activist show for the activists in your community, I think is a good start. So, you've done that, and, reaching out as much as possible to the people in your community. My experience is that when you put yourself out there, it turns out that there's often other people that are ready to take a similar stand and ready to support you. I don't know the specifics of either the organizations in that area or really the specifics of your case. I can't give
right,
any.
Right, but we
any
do have the Capitol here. I'm trying to look at that as an opportunity of like, oh my gosh, we've got the legislature.
Well, Patty, we're probably not able to get into the specifics of your
right.
case at this time, and I know Tim does have to go. But thank you so much for calling in and. And definitely, get in touch with whatever groups are out there. I'm sure there's a lot of stuff online, too. So,
yeah, thanks for encouraging me. Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for calling.
Okay.
Any last words for our audience, Tim?
I'm grateful for the opportunity to be able to share this story even more. I've been extremely excited and encouraged by this trial this week. I'm really excited to see how it turns out here in the next couple of days, and I'm feeling really good about it. I think we could have a really historic decision by the end of this week.
So you think it's going to be wrapped up by the end of the week?
Yeah, things are actually moving ahead of schedule, so we could have a decision as early as Thursday or very likely on Friday.
Okay. Well, I do want to respect your time, and I really appreciate your speaking with us. Sorry to our other listeners who weren't able to get their calls in, but if you stay on the line, we can talk as well on the air. Thanks a lot, Tim DeChristopher.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And we do have another caller. I don't know if you want to still talk on the air. Ken, if you want to still talk, Tim had to go, but go ahead.
Well, It was a great program. I'm disappointed I couldn't get on because specifically I was interested in knowing whether he ever made use of the community rights group. And I believe that you have interviewed Paul Cienfuegos, have you not? And whether or not they ever made use of the Community Environmental Legal Defense People Fund.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That you may have been the person who called and asked that question. I kept on putting that off because we had other callers.
Yeah, I noticed that.
We had other callers live on the air. I apologize for that.
No apologies necessary. But my other question, and I'll hang up and you can take other callers, is I wanted to ask him what he thinks the status of jury nullification is going to be in the future, because he clearly decided to get a jury trial. And, you know, it's not always, the prosecutors don't always win in this case, especially if the juries are made up of knowledgeable people and principled people rather than being browbeaten by the prosecution.
Well, okay. Why don't you use this time to let us know what jury nullification actually is?
Oh, yeah, well, it's when, you opt for a jury trial, and the judge makes a decision that you have to go to jail, but the jury decides whether or not they're going to sanction that, and on occasion they've said that it's wrong, and actually the jury's decision has precedence over the judge's decision.
So juries can actually change a judge's decision?
Yes.
And does that have a body of law supporting it?
Well, so far as I'm not a lawyer, I have no idea, but maybe some of your subsequent callers can enlighten us.
Great.
Okay, well, thank you, Paul.
Yeah, thank you for calling in, Ken.
Bye.
Go ahead. And we do have another caller. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to put a message out there. I've heard a lot of great things about the power of civil disobedience, but I've heard it spoken of as kind of like an exotic thing, something that happens, you know, out in the woods or up in that part of the country where we're not. And really, civil disobedience, if it is going to become an effective strategy for working people, for common people, is going to have to happen in very kind of everyday places like apartment buildings and workplaces. And when we disobey, we need to consider that we must disobey powers that aren't just the official governments, but the ones that are closer to us and that we may feel are, you know, too private to actually question. So that's just my point.
And that's a good one. Disobedience comes in many forms, and it doesn't just all, it doesn't always mean necessarily breaking the law per se. Could mean breaking informal rules of behavior that say enforce patriarchal modes of interacting. It may mean breaking administrative rules. It may mean breaking rules at work. It could mean all kinds of things. It may mean talking back to police who don't expect to be talked back to, creating more of a general climate of people standing up for themselves and against these authority figures who only have legitimacy to some extent, obviously backed up by the barrel of a gun, but also backed up by our own consent. So thank you for that. Are you still there?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. And we only have a couple minutes left. Do we have any other callers? So that's all the callers. If anybody wants to sneak in a last call, I know Tim is already gone. I just want to flag a really interesting article kind of along the lines of what I was talking about. Again, I'd highly recommend this book, Green is the New Red. I've heard a lot about it. I am reading it right now by Will Potter, also his website, Green is the New Red. There's an article that just came out yesterday. Homeland Security shut down branch investigating militia movement after Republican pressure. An insider's account of how Homeland Security ignored the biggest terror threat. Well, you know, in the 2000s, this whole eco-terrorism thing, which hit the Northwest so hard, and of course, that's a whole other huge conversation, you know, the issue of various tactics compared to each other. Obviously, arson was a major tactic used by Earth Liberation Front, and many people may not agree with that tactic. I certainly have serious reservations about the way that whole thing went down, but the whole exaggerated sentencing of people who, you know, in a movement that caused no loss of life and no injuries, compared to the hands-off approach to these militia movements, and again, this article saying that the Homeland Security actually shut down their branch investigating the militia movement. Spencer Sunshine, who I interviewed last week about what's going on in Malheur, has been doing some really good reporting. He's out there in Burns now. Hopefully we'll get a chance to talk to him. He's done some reports on the militia movement with Political Research Associates. The Rural Organizing Project is doing some really good out there. That's all the time we have. So many different threads to go. But check out this Delta5Trial.org, which is what we've been mainly talking about, and ClimateDisobedienceCenter.org. For Wednesday Talk Radio, this is Paul Rowland. Thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned for more great programming. Political Perspectives is next.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, and the time is now 8:59, actually 9 o'clock. Today's weather is showers with a high near 47. Coming up next on The Boo is Kathleen Stevenson. At 10, it's Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on The Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen speaks with guest Jim Gilbert about pruning kiwis and persimmons, suggestions about what you can use for mulch and chilling hours, and why many plants need them to thrive. Thanks very much for listening to KBOO, and thanks, members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned for Kathleen Stevenson with Political Perspectives.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month,